If you're tired and feeling lonely.
Every day, prominent Republicans across the country tell us that Trump was responsible for the attack on the Capitol.
I do think he was responsible. I think the whole idea was to intimidate Congress.
President Trump is responsible for provoking the events of the day.
You said it is clear that President Trump's rhetoric and actions contributed to the insurrection. Do you stand by that statement?
100%.
But sadly, these same Republicans say they will vote for him again.
You're voting for someone who you believe tried to subvert the peaceful transfer of power.
The answer to the question is yes.
Would you support him for president, even though you believe he contributed to an insurrection?
Yeah, me and 51% of America.
I said that I would support President Trump if he were the nominee, and he obviously is going to be the nominee of our party.
These Republicans are suffering from partisan derangement syndrome.
You don't see this as the definition of putting party over country?
No.
At this point in the ad, I would tell you to call this number so you can help these deranged partisan Republicans. But sadly, they're too far gone.
Sadly. They are. Incredible.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
And that's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also elsewhere in California, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Hawaii, Ohio, New York, Louisiana, New Mexico, New Hampshire, Arkansas, Washington State, West Virginia, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and other fine states around this fine nation. We also stream coast to coast every day on the internet, so the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Coming up, we will be joined momentarily by Mueller, She Wrote's Dr. Allison Gill, otherwise known as AG, and attorney Keith Barber, otherwise known as Keith DB, over at Daily Kos for our New York Trump trial midweek catch-up with a K-Day. To get you all up to speed on Trump's latest legal woes as his 2016 election interference via hush money to porn stars trial continues, even as it takes a break on Wednesdays. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
Before we get there, however, some election news of note today. You may or may not be happy to know, depending on, well, you'll see. it's all but official, but following a special U.S. House election in left-leaning upstate western New York on Tuesday, Republicans will now have a paper-thin one-single-vote margin in the U.S. House, at least for a few weeks until some other special elections are held after a victory by Democrats on Tuesday, when Democratic State Senator Timothy Kennedy had little difficulty defeating Republican town supervisor and Donald Trump supporter Gary Dixon in a special election to fill the 26th congressional district seat that was vacated in the U.S. House by Democrat Brian Higgins, who resigned, citing the growing dysfunction in Congress. I'm sure I don't know what he's talking about. Kennedy ran on reproductive rights, immigration, stronger gun safety laws like those passed by New York State after a 2022 mass shooting at a Buffalo supermarket. In his victory speech, Kennedy said, quote, "We need to elect pro-democracy, anti-MAGA candidates all around the country this November, and it starts here in Buffalo, New York, tonight." Earlier this year, the GOP's slim House majority was already narrowed by a different U.S. House election, special election in New York, a closely contested Long Island area special election that followed New York Republican George Santos's expulsion from Congress. That race was also won by a Democrat, Democrat Tom Suozzi. And here we have yet another case of what Newsweek is describing today as Democrats, quote, massively overperforming as compared to recent polling. They note the independent Cook Political Report, which analyzes elections and campaigns, expected the Democratic candidate Kennedy to win the seat, but by 9 percentage points. That, after Congressman Higgins, who vacated the seat after serving since 2005, won his re-election as a longtime incumbent back in 2022 by 28 points. Well, on Tuesday, with 94% of the unofficial results in as we go to air, it wasn't a 9 percentage point win. Kennedy trounced Dixon 68-32%. That is a 36-point margin.
Wow. That's a lot.
Suggesting yet again that Democrats are being underpolled somehow, as we've seen this pattern repeat over and over, with Democrats overperforming in actual elections versus the polls. We've seen this again and again since 2020. Again, they thought he was going to win by 9 points. He won by 36 points in a district where the Democrat last won by 22 points. So Bradley Moss, the national security attorney, tweeted, every time people actually go to vote as opposed to just get polled, we see something different from what the pollsters had predicted. And yep, it happened again in New York, New York 26 on Tuesday, for what it's worth. In some other 2024 election and voting rights related news today, if they can't win by being more popular, I guess Republicans will just have to keep making it harder to vote and to have your vote counted as cast. The Trump appointee-heavy Third Circuit Court of Appeals will not rehear an election case out of the critical battleground state of Pennsylvania, as TPM's Kate Riga reported on Tuesday, leaving voting rights lawyers at this point with some difficult choices to make. They have to pick between dwindling options to prevent mail-in ballots from being tossed out during this November's critical election. The fight centers on the date that voters must write on the outer envelope holding the ballot in Pennsylvania. If it is wrong in any way or missing because a voter just didn't notice it, the ballot must go uncounted in Pennsylvania, even though none of the parties involved in the case assert that those dates are actually used for anything. A lot of times people forget to put their to put that date in there, or they put their birth date in there accidentally.
In other words, working hard to toss it on technical issues, not because the voter is not who they say they are, for example.
Ari Savitsky, the lead attorney on the case for the ACLU, said people are going to have their votes not counted under this ruling for totally immaterial reasons, like writing 2023 on the ballot instead of 2024. Which, by the way, I do all the time still. Yesterday, when I posted yesterday's broadcast at bradblog.com, I said it was, I put the year as 3024. Oh, I don't know what I was thinking, but if I had done that on a ballot, it would have gotten it tossed out. Filling out the date on this form, he noted, has nothing to do with anything. National Democratic organizations are supporting the voting rights groups here. Republican ones are fighting to nix those ballots. Democratic voters in Pennsylvania are overwhelmingly more likely to vote by mail than Republicans in the state. So Republicans are taking their chances and saying, yeah, we can't count those ballots. A Third Circuit panel had ruled 2-1 against the voting rights groups late last month before the full court decided not to rehear the matter. This week, after that three-judge panel found that the date requirement did not violate the federal materiality provision of the Civil Rights Act, meant to bar states from using trivial mistakes or omissions to disenfranchise people. Southern states habitually used these type of tiny errors as a pretext to keep black people from voting. That prompted Congress to draft this particular provision that says you can't throw it out just for a tiny mistake, an immaterial mistake. Despite the admitted uselessness of the envelope date, however, the majority on the Third Circuit found that the materiality provision only applied to questions that determine whether a person is qualified to vote in the first place and cannot gird against state-level requirements in casting the ballot. By that logic, Savitsky said, states in the Jim Crow South that Congress was so worried about would say, well, now we can just say, all right, you can register, but good luck on that ballot application form. That is exactly what Congress did not want, Savitsky said. It is not good textualism. It is not good history, he added. Now he and his team have to decide how to best proceed. They can appeal this ruling to the corrupted U.S. Supreme Court. Good luck with that. Or they can drop back down to the trial court level where they have a still live constitutional claim under the Equal Protection Clause. The trial court did not initially reach a decision on the equal protection part of this case. They ruled that the materiality provision was enough to give the voting rights groups the win until the appeals court overruled it. In any event, there are risks to both paths, Riga reports. The Supreme Court sporadically applies the so-called Purcell principle, the idea that states should not change voting rules too close to an election due to both voter confusion and election administration burdens. The court has been all over the map, however, in terms of what constitutes too close to an election. They seem to make it up as they go, depending on which rulings that they want to keep in place and which ones they want to block. So stick a pin in that Purcell principle idea for a moment. I'm going to get back to that in another story here today. But if the voting rights groups in Pennsylvania decide that the equal protection claim is the stronger case at this point, then they'll ask for a rehearing down at the trial level. But speed becomes a very real concern. The trial court is teed up to actually act quickly on this because it's already seen and considered the claim to some degree. But the litigation would have to proceed at an emergency pace in order to be settled before the election. Then they'll have all of the appellate arguments going back and forth. All of that will have to fit in somehow before the election. Good luck. In the meantime, election administrators in the Commonwealth have tried to save voters from their own costly mistakes by redesigning the ballot envelope. But still, some voters made these date errors back in the midterm elections, according to an AP report. Now, the number of ballots tossed for date issues, they find, are relatively few, but margins matter in battleground states like Pennsylvania. Throughout various elections, Savitsky said, we have seen half a percentage point to 1 point of mail ballots thrown out. And that adds up, he says, across the state, that's tens of thousands of people in a big turnout election. So we will be keeping our eyes on this because only, you know, the presidency itself and which party controls the U.S. Senate may come down to what happens in Pennsylvania in what could be a very close race in 2024. We will keep our eyes on it moving forward. Also on Tuesday, and this case is just, this is just bizarre. Maybe it's not bizarre. Maybe I should expect it by now. But a federal three-judge panel on Tuesday threw out Louisiana's recently redrawn congressional map, which would have created a second black voting district for the U.S. House, leaving the state now without a settled congressional map just 6 months before the November elections. In this 2-1 ruling, the far-right Fifth Circuit panel found that the redistricting map approved by the GOP-controlled Louisiana state legislature in a measure known as SB 8, which established a second majority black congressional district in the state. Finally, the panel found, quote, it violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment as an impermissible racial gerrymander. This ruling seems to turn the Equal Protection Clause and the Voting Rights Act upside down, especially after a protracted legal fight to even get us to this point where the state was forced, essentially, to add this second majority black district. The majority opinion on this three-judge panel states that the state of Louisiana is prohibited from using SB 8's map of congressional districts for any election. Two Donald Trump-appointed judges on that panel represented the court majority opinion. A Bill Clinton-appointed judge dissented in this case. An appeal in this case would go directly to where? The U.S. Supreme Court. The court will convene on May 6th to discuss the remedial process, which, given the fact that Louisianans have already held their congressional primaries this year, on March 23, a remedial process here could get pretty weird. What do we do? We've already elected, the candidates who are going to be running in November under these maps. Are we going to redraw everything and rehold the entire state's congressional primary? The map that was struck down had been approved by the Republican state legislature in January after a different federal court, had found that the existing map illegally diminished black voting power. So this map was meant to correct it. And now a separate court with a couple of Trump appointees had said, nope, undo it again.
Wait, so drawing a map that doesn't discriminate against black voters somehow discriminates against white voters?
That seems to be what they're saying. It's an unlawful racial gerrymander.
Wow.
There has, of course, been a years-long court battle to give black voters in Louisiana adequate voting representation. Previously, black voters in Louisiana had a majority in just one single congressional district out of six, despite making up nearly a third of the state's population. So, yeah, give them two out of six. That would seem to be right. But this court overturned it. So I suspect this will, in fact, go to the Supreme Court, where, remember that Purcell principle I mentioned? Where you're not supposed to make changes to the election rules too close to the election in order to avoid confusion for voters and for election administrators. Well, this is going to be a great test of our corrupted Supreme Court.
Oh, boy.
In this case, the voters have already voted, and the candidates are already chosen to run this November in the districts on the state's new map. So if there was any consistency to Purcell, obviously, the Supremes here would rule that the election must be run on the maps that were already chosen and leave the question of that three-judge panel for another day. That's what they should choose. We will see what they do. As you may have heard, the Supreme Court is wildly corrupt and almost always in the bag for Republicans. So this is going to be a very interesting test for them and their so-called, frankly, made up out of whole cloth Purcell principle. Let's see if they stick to it this time. All right, let's take a quick break here, and we will come back with Trump's stormy weather in New York City, which continues with our midweek catch-up on his first, but hopefully not last, criminal trial with Mueller, she wrote, Allison Gill, and Daily Kos's Keith Barber. That's straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial. Hey, it's Brad. Well, we are here in another critical presidential election year. We cover elections like no other outlet in the nation. This election year will be a big one like none other. It could even be the last one, depending on how it goes. Seriously. Please help the broadcast continue in this critical election year. Support our work right now with a generous donation via bradblog.com/donate. Help keep the broadcast and bradblog.com free for all. We couldn't do any of this without you. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate right now. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
I know why he can't hold his head up high. Stormy Daniels. She went through all the legal channels.
She did.
Keeps talking all the time.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Well, the New York criminal trial against Donald J. Trump for his 2016 election interference via hush money payments, that resumes on Thursday, giving us a chance to catch up today on what happened so far this week in the first ever criminal trial of a U.S. president. But I have a feeling not necessarily the last criminal trial of a U.S. president. While the court was off on Monday, we've had just one day of proceedings so far this week. It was an eventful day, however, and it comes on the heels of last week's outrageous and ridiculous oral argument at the corrupted U.S. Supreme Court on the absurd argument of whether presidents have complete and total criminal immunity from any and all crimes that they carry out while in office. As Trump is arguing, and as a not inconsequential number of corrupt Republican appointees on that high court seemed willing to play along with, at least long enough to continue delaying Trump's federal criminal trial for having attempted to steal the 2020 presidential election, forestalling that trial most likely until after he is allowed to run for president again in 2024. But meanwhile, on Tuesday in New York Superior Court, Justice Juan Merchan in his courtroom before the disgraced former president found him guilty of 9 counts of contempt of court for having repeatedly violated the judge's gag order, barring Trump from attacking witnesses and jurors via posts on his social media and campaign website. With the judge lamenting his limited options under New York law of fining him no more than $1,000 and or sending Trump to jail for 30 days for each of those 9 violations. For now, the judge chose the former, a $9,000 fine and a threat that Trump's next violation going forward could result in jail time. And in the case proper, the prosecution continued to present methodical evidence and witnesses on Tuesday in support of the 34 criminal felony charges filed against Trump related to election interference in the weeks before the 2016 election, as Trump, in a panic following the release of the Access Hollywood tape, revealing him bragging about sexually assaulting women, resulted in his friend David Pecker, who ran the National Enquirer at the time, paying out hush money to Playboy playmate Karen McDougal, with whom Trump is said to have had a nearly year-long extramarital affair, to catch and kill her story. And Trump's lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, taking out a second mortgage on his own home to pay $130,000 to porn star Stormy Daniels to keep her quiet about her sexual liaison with Trump while his wife was nursing their newborn son. Tuesday's witnesses included experts who helped authenticate various videos and transcripts of Trump's rallies and his past depositions, the banker who helped facilitate Cohen's payment to Stormy Daniels, for which he was paid back by Trump during the first year of his presidency, and the attorney for both Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, explaining how the hush money payments were carried out. Joining us now for perspective on all of these things and probably more to catch up on the week and all of these unspooling historic proceedings and where they all go from here. Our two excellent guests, both watching these trials closely. Dr. Allison Gill is a Navy veteran, author, and host of the Daily Beans podcast, and a contributing host to the notorious long-running Mueller, She Wrote podcast and Twitter handle. OAG, welcome back to the broadcast. It has been far too long.
Yeah, it's been like a year, Brad. I'm glad we have a criminal president so that we can bring us together.
Yeah, well, there's been nothing to talk about over that past year with you, I guess, Allison. Also, our old friend Keith Barber, former U.S. Army captain. So it's sort of an Army-Navy thing today, I guess. He's also a former attorney, former lifelong Republican, and current contributor to the Progressive Daily Coast website on legal and constitutional matters, where he is known as simply Keith DB. He is also, by the way, the father of Bethany Barber, whose dulcet tones were heard at the top of this segment, singing her Stormy Weather Variations. Welcome back, Counselor Keith.
Thank you, Brad. And I got to say that I'm fanboying to be on here with Allison. I'm a big fan of her Mueller She Wrote.
There you go. Who isn't? All right, let's speak with Mueller She Wrote, Allison Gill, since it's been so long since we last spoke with you. Before we drill down into some of the details here, I'd love to just get your sort of broad overview for the moment on our New York criminal story so far, given that for months now, Trumpers have been claiming that all of these criminal indictments and trials against Trump are only going to help him out, help him gain support among American voters and among Trump opponents. We've heard, you know, laments that the New York case of the four criminal trials that Trump is facing, that was not a particularly strong one against him. But we're now about 2.5 weeks into that New York trial. What is your sort of broad take on how things are going for the former president and for New York prosecutors at this point in general?
Well, I think it's a very strong case. I agree with some former prosecutors like Ambassador Norm Eisen, for example, who has been arguing that this is a very straightforward, strong, documents-based, evidence-based case. And I think that the prosecutors have done an excellent job laying it all out in the opening statements. And now it's going like a kind of like a freight train with all the different witnesses coming up. And I think that I was very surprised that they were able to select a jury in the first week. I thought we might be looking at a couple of weeks at least to select a jury. But it went very quickly and it seems to be going very quickly. I think the big stories are the peppering of contempt violations that we keep getting. We have another hearing tomorrow morning.
Yep. And we are going to get to those. Allison, the New York Times reported on Tuesday, I believe it was, that apparently Trump is just furious at his attorneys that they are not being aggressive enough. He's complaining about how much they are costing him, even though it seems to be Trump's MAGA chumps, you know, his Republican donors who are actually paying for all of this. But what does that tell us, if anything, about how Donald Trump thinks his case is going at this point?
Well, we have in the disgraced former president a fellow who is not used to being held accountable and who is not used to being in charge of his environment and being surrounded by yes men and women. So I think it's very difficult for him to sit still. As we know, so a lot of reporters have noted, he's falling asleep in the courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
And as Chris Hayes said, if you call your opponent Sleepy Joe, you have one job. and that's to stay awake. But it's not going well for him to not be in charge, to have to sit there, to have to listen, especially during voir dire, to all of the mean tweets about him, and what everybody actually thinks about him.
Yeah.
To not be able to speak, to stand up and talk. That's why he has to go out at the breaks and, you know, talk to the microphones, talk to the press, and continue to violate his gag orders. But, you know, I think it's very difficult for him. He's having a really hard time. And, of course, he misses Cohn, his lawyer, that, you know, he wishes everybody could be like them. But, you know, we're in a position now where these attorneys are losing credibility with the court. I think I remember the first day when the judge, Judge Marchand, looked at his counsel and said, "You are losing all credibility." And I was kind of blown away by that moment. Yeah. I'm not a lawyer, but I mean, I'm assuming, Keith, you probably thought the same thing when you heard that, for like right off the bat. It's got to be very difficult to be a Trump lawyer. As I've said, Mar-a-Lago is a magical place where people enter as lawyers and leave as witnesses.
Yes. And by the way, just to be clear, that's Roy Cohn that that Trump was lamenting having lost, his longtime attorney and attorney for Richard Nixon and so forth, just not to mix him up with Michael Cohen. Keith, and I was going to ask about this later, but as long as Allison brought it up, this idea of Trump continuously closing his eyes throughout the proceedings, either sleeping or resting, or he claims he's praying. I have a theory, Keith. I'd love to hear your. I know. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. I understand that cops will tell you that when they haul someone in. Who is innocent and throw them in a jail cell during proceedings, they pace around, they're quite agitated. Whereas guilty people, when they throw them in jail like that, just tend to fall asleep in their cell. Have you ever heard of that before? And might that be a part of what is going on here?
I have not heard of that before, but mm-hmm. I would tell you that I think an attorney would tell his client that one of the worst things he can do while sitting there in front of the jury is to go to sleep and communicate to the jury that you're not interested in what they're doing. And you're not interested in the fact that they have given up, a chunk of their lives to determine whether or not you are guilty of a crime. And it's just a horrible thing for Trump to be doing in front of the jury. It's stupid. But why does he do it? Because he can't control himself.
Yeah, I think it's just some sort of emotional narcolepsy, and he just can't deal with what is going on. Let's talk, and that's sort of his way of checking out. Keith, let's talk a little bit about the 9 criminal contempt of court violations by Trump for violating the gag order against attacking witnesses and jurors. On yesterday's program, we cited veteran prosecutor Glenn Kirshner suggesting that things might go quote, from bad to worse for Trump with that ruling in his other criminal cases where his bail agreements include not violating any other laws while out on bail. I know you wrote about this as well at Daily Kos on Tuesday. What are or might be the consequences in those other cases based on Justice Merchan's ruling on Tuesday?
Yeah, I looked up Trump's conditions of release for the insurrection case in the District of Columbia. And it's quite clear. It just says that Trump, quote, must not violate federal, state, or local law while on release. Those are the exact words of it. And it doesn't even say criminal law. So these contempt things are kind of, I guess, in a gray area there, but it's a criminal contempt finding for which a potential penalty includes jail. That sounds to me more like a crime than a civil determination. And I think it could apply, of course, in that Kos piece. I said it won't.
Why?
And it won't even be seriously discussed. And that's what I find really kind of disturbing about this whole thing, because if it was anyone else named, something other than Trump, if it was somebody named Allison Gill or Keith Barber or Brad, this would be considered. It would be considered that, for the federal prosecutor to file a motion in the District of Columbia to, rescind Trump's release on grounds that he has violated it. And it won't even be considered. There's no way Jack Smith is even going to try it. And I think Judge Chutkan probably wouldn't do it in any event, but it's something that would certainly be on the table for anybody else. And yes, for all of Trump screaming about two-tier justice, there is indeed two-tier justice going on here, and it is favoring him.
Allison, can you envision, because I'm still having a tough time seeing it, never mind the attorneys in the other cases using that as a reason to revoke his bail, but can you even envision at this point Justice Merchan actually jailing Trump if he does violate the gag order again?
Well, I can. Not this week, but maybe, perhaps eventually, because he did say in his ruling of his $9,000 fine, as you said, he expressed regret that I, you know, but for I only have $1,000 to fine you,
right,
per violation, and that does definitely put jail on the table for future stuff. We have that second contempt hearing tomorrow. I imagine there'll be more fines, another round of fines. But, you know, with regard to other prosecutors jailing him for violating his bail conditions, if past is prologue, remember, this isn't the first time Trump has been found guilty of contempt. Judge Engoron hit him with a $10,000 a day fine for not handing over documents in discovery in the New York Attorney General civil fraud trial. Judge Engoron also hit him with two separate fines of totaling, I think, $15,000 for violating his gag order by attacking his law clerk.
Mm-hmm.
So he has been held in criminal contempt of court before, and we haven't seen any action on the bail conditions in the other jurisdictions. So I don't see it happening that way, but I do see if he continues to violate these gag order, to violate this limited gag order here, that Judge Mershon will at some point put him in jail. And the Secret Service has been reported as having meetings to discuss what that would look like with Secret Service and jailing Donald Trump, not necessarily for conviction in, you know, in this trial or future trials, which they also should be meeting about, but for contempt.
Well, it'll be interesting because, you know, we hear people say, oh, Donald Trump can't control himself. I think Keith mentioned that, you know, in the courtroom, he just can't control himself, falls asleep. I think he can very much control himself. And I think he sort of got a freebie on Thursday with these four additional contempt complaints from the prosecutor because they were made. They happened before Mershon came out with his ruling. But now that Mershon was pretty clear about this, you know, going forward, if you do it again, my only real option is jail here. I would be surprised if Trump took that bait at this point. I think he knows exactly what he's doing, and he's in control of it. We'll see if I'm right about that. Allison, the judge also noted that Trump does have the right to defend himself against attacks that do come from people like Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels, you know, who are named specifically, and that he might have to further amend the gag order if such attacks persist in that regard. Is that a message to Cohen and Stormy to knock it off? And by the way, can they be held in contempt for their behavior in this case?
Not without a gag order in place, I don't think. But I do think that was a shot across the bow, particularly to Michael Cohen, who spent his first week live TikToking and fundraising on going after Donald Trump. But Michael Cohen did speak to ABC, and he did put out on Twitter, I don't call it X, all right, I'll stop. So he got the message from somewhere. I don't know if Lanny Davis told him. I don't know if maybe George Conway gave him a call and said, put a lid on it, bro.
Right.
But he did get the message before that warning to him came out, and he has stopped. So I don't think they can be held in contempt unless they are gagged and then violate. Then we start with fines and we start the whole thing over. By then the trial will be over. But I do think that he got the message. And I don't necessarily know that or have seen what Stormy Daniels is saying, but I'm sure she got the message too.
Keith, the violation of that gag order, of course, was big news on Tuesday, even as the jurors were not in the courtroom during that hearing, as I understand it. And I guess the jury has been instructed to avoid news from the trial. Good luck doing that. I mean, it's hard to see how they could avoid at least the headline that Trump was, you know, found guilty of contempt of court for violating that order. Does something like that affect the way jurors see the defendant if they see a headline, Trump found guilty of contempt?
Yeah, it probably will, which, of course, is why the judge tries to tell them not to look at, any news to do with this at all. And basically, I think jurors are expected to live underneath a rock or in a cave for the duration of the trial, and that's awfully tough to happen.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's an issue, and yes, jurors tend to relate with the judge. They know that the attorneys are just hired guns, you know, for the prosecution and for the defendant.
they, you know, if they relate to anyone in the courtroom and view anyone in the courtroom as a friend and an advocate for them, it's the judge. And the judge often does play that part as well. Mm. So, you know, when the judge does something that reflects adversely on a party, and if it does get to the jury, you know, that works against that party.
Moving to the to some of the actual testimony this week, Keith Barber, the C-SPAN archivist, was called in from out of state to authenticate some of the videos of Trump at his rallies that is being introduced as evidence by the prosecution. They also called a guy who works for a well-known court reporting and deposition transcription service in Manhattan. He had to testify to the authenticity of transcripts that were apparently already used without challenge in the E. Jean Carroll case. How unusual is that in a trial to bring in these people to just testify to the authenticity of the evidence? And why was it done in this case?
Well, that's standard procedure. You can't just throw the evidence out there. You pretty much have to use a witness to introduce it, and you have to assure the jury and the court that it's the real McCoy, that it's an authentic document.
But can't they just agree to that beforehand in case it, like transcripts and videos that are obviously Donald Trump?
They could, but it actually works better to bring the witness up and say, I verified this. You know, and in this case, one of the clips that the C-SPAN archivist showed was of Donald Trump himself saying that Michael Cohen is a very talented lawyer. I mean, Trump's attorneys, when Cohen testifies, are going to go after him like, you know, pit bulls on a chicken. And you know, they're going to try and undermine that by saying that, you know, Michael Cohen was Trump's respected attorney, and if you doubt that, just listen to what Trump said about Michael Cohen.
Allison Gill, attorney Keith Davidson was called by the prosecution to testify on Tuesday. He represented both Karen McDougal and Stormy Daniels somehow in their hush money negotiations with the National Enquirer and with Michael Cohen. So, Allison, two-part question here. A, well, what did Davidson testify to, and B, can you explain to me how the hell he ended up representing both Karen McDougal and Stormy Daniels?
Oh, well, I've long said, I think, since all this started coming out in 2019, that this looks like a racket. It looks like Cohen and Davidson were working together to catch and kill these stories and make a little money, make a third of the money off of it, you know, for themselves. And so he, I think he was the go-to rep for these women as part of this conspiracy. And Keith Davidson's testimony, I think, was really good and very important. I mean, he basically is helping tell the story that the prosecution laid out in opening statements by saying, you know, well, at first, AMI was paying these women. Then when we couldn't get the money paid back from Trump, we said, we're done. We're not in the buying the story business anymore. And that's when Michael Cohen had to step in himself and go across to First National Bank and get a loan, a HELOC, to pay this back with the understanding that Trump was going to reimburse him. So I think one of the most important pieces of testimony from Davidson was that Cohen stepped in for AMI. And that as part of the conspiracy to impact the campaign, which, as you know, is one of the three underlying felonies that elevate the falsification of business records from misdemeanors to felonies. Mm-hmm. The other two being tax fraud, because Trump paid him back $400,000+ to true up what the, you know, the income tax on the reimbursement. And the third being making in-kind federal campaign finance violations for making donations that are above the limit. But that it is against the law in New York to conspire to impact the outcome of the election. And I did want to ask Keith, because you're a lawyer, I'm not, I have a question, because I'm concerned with the overturning of the Weinstein verdict in New York, which Alvin Bragg has said he's going to retry for Sandoval stuff, right? Because of criminal past acts. Basically, Weinstein said he couldn't get a fair trial because he was bullied out of testifying in his own defense because of all of these Sandoval approved prior bad acts that were going to come up. And the New York Superior Court, you guys have a weird, it's a weird thing over there. It's not the highest court in New York agreed with him and tossed out his conviction. And I'm concerned because I think 6 or 7 out of the 13 different bad acts have been approved if Trump testifies. And I'm concerned that Trump will appeal, saying he didn't get to testify in his own defense because of these possible prior bad acts being brought up to impeach him.
Yeah, and that was an interesting and I thought very odd decision by the New York appellate court there, because what's the expectation? What's the fix to this? Sandoval requires that prosecutors disclose what prior wrongful acts impinging upon moral character or honesty in order to impeach a defendant who waives the Fifth Amendment to testify is going to be used, which specific acts they're going to call upon. So, you know, in the Weinstein case, the prosecutors did that. And similar to this case, the court approved it. And then they did it. They didn't do it because Weinstein didn't testify. And, you know, the argument, the whole thing rests on a hypothetical. Well, I would have if the judge hadn't ruled this way in Sandoval. So, you know, I'm not sure, and I'm certainly not an expert on New York law, but that just struck me as a very odd approach to this.
Wrong or right. What do you do? It's the same court that would be deciding an appeal for Trump.
Yeah. And what do you do? I mean, frankly, if it gets to the stage where Trump has to appeal this to an appellate court, I'll be happy. There's that. And if we get to a conviction where we are now, I'll be happy with that.
I know they've had the Sandoval hearing already. Has Judge Merchan made his ruling on the Sandoval issues?
Yes.
He did.
Mm-hmm. And so your concern, Allison, is that that would be used in the same way that Weinstein did on appeal to throw this whole thing out because, Donald Trump wasn't able to testify on his behalf because of all the terrible things that the prosecution would have been allowed to point out about him.
Yeah, the same thing that got Weinstein thrown out by the same court that would be hearing his appeal. But of course, you know, it all depends on how you define justice. For me, it's always just been indict him, get him into the justice system. For me, I think justice has been served. A lot of people want to see convictions and jail, or, you know, that there's going to be months and months of sentencing pushback, and then there'll be appeals, and then it could be thrown out. You know, we saw McDonald and his conviction get thrown out by the Supreme Court in 2017 or so for bribery.
Right.
Does that mean that Trump is that Trump's awesome, or that he's been completely exonerated? No. So right. I think everybody has to kind of temper their expectations of what justice means, because all of these convictions, when and if they happen, will be appealed.
Allison, what should we expect? Let's move forward a little bit. What should we expect from the prosecution in the coming days? I think Keith Davidson is still on the stand. He has not completed his testimony. Is that correct?
I think that's correct. And then we should start seeing those quote-unquote blockbuster witnesses. It'll be interesting to see whether they, I think because of the chronology of it, I think Karen McDougal will testify before Stormy Daniels, but it'll be interesting to see where they plug Michael Cohen into the equation. I'm very interested in the, I guess, continuity and chronology of the story, because that's what's so important to present to the jury, at least from what my friends who are actual lawyers, court trial lawyers, tell me is important.
Lawyer Keith, what do you see as what the prosecution needs to, what is the case that they need to make in the coming days to the juror? Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with Allison, and I think that they're trying to set up Cohen's testimony. They know that the defense is going to go after him hard because, you know, he is a convicted liar, course, he was convicted of lying in order to protect Trump.
Right.
They're going to say, try and communicate to the jury that Cohen is a convicted liar, so you, the jury, should not believe a single word this guy says. And what the prosecution is trying to do now and is building towards is saying, well, you know what? You don't have to believe everything Cohen said. You won't have to, because you will have heard the same thing from, you know, Mr. Pecker, and you will have heard the same thing from Keith Davidson, and you will have seen the same thing in documents and texts and emails and so forth. So, you know, if this was all about, you know, if this was Cohen's word alone, there would be an issue here, but it's not. You have all of these other things that are going to corroborate what Cohen says, and that's what they're setting it up for.
There was
that's why they're bringing in all of these guys before Cohen, so that when Cohen comes in and says it, the jury will be nodding their head in agreement, saying, yeah, we've heard all of this before.
And I think during the testimony with the attorney Keith Davidson, they were talking about what a jerk Michael Cohen is. So maybe he'll be, by the time he shows up, they'll be, well, he's not such a jerk. He's a nice guy. Also, there was this banker, Gary Farrow, who testified on Tuesday. During his testimony, he talked about how the bank account was set up by Michael Cohen in a real hurry. He was really desperate to get this thing set up to pay the hush money to Daniels. Apparently, that banker revealed that at no point was Donald Trump ever discussed by Michael Cohen during that transaction. The banker also said that he had no idea that it was, you know, to pay off a porn star, that there was anything political about this account that Michael said had set up under the name Essential Consultants LLC. But the banker notes that, you know, Trump never came up. He never spoke to Trump. Does that present a problem for the prosecution, with Trump claiming essentially that Michael Cohen was acting on his own when he paid off $130,000 to pay off Stormy Daniels?
I don't. Of course, Trump's team is going to claim that, but it was necessary for Cohen to deceive that banker in the way he did. Otherwise, he wouldn't be able to get the loan. If he was told the banker, well, this is really, you know, for Donald Trump to pay off a porn star, the loan would have never been made. So the fact that Cohen hid it from the banker, I don't think really means much of anything. And, you know, what the jury is going to see is checks written and signed by Donald Trump to Michael Cohen, paying him back for the loan that he got from that bank.
In 2017, while he was in the White House.
Which, yes, yeah. Front written, signed and written in the Oval Office.
Yes. Allison, we got to get out here, but Eric Trump finally showed up in court apparently on Tuesday. And I think that's the first time, as far as I can tell, that any Trump family member was at these proceedings. Also on Tuesday, as I understand it, there were a few more Trump protesters outside of court. I've got this theory that these protesters are never going to show up for him, that those people who, you know, showed up en masse on January 6th were showing up because they thought their country, that there was an election that was at stake, that it's not because of love for Donald Trump. Your thoughts on Eric in court and the, I guess, lack of Trump supporters outside of court over the past several weeks?
Yeah, well, deterrence works, right? There's a lot of January 6th insurrectionists, yes, that are sitting in jail right now.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of the point. But, you know, yeah, Eric showed up, even though his dad didn't go to his graduation. And I think it's funny that the judge said, I'm going to give you the day off so you can go to Barron's graduation. And now Trump has to go his son's graduation.
That's exactly what I thought. Oh, crap. Now I got to go.
Yeah, he's not under court order to go or anything. This is going to look really, really bad for him to cry about not being able to go and then not showing up. Now he has to go.
Right.
But Eric was there. Carter Page was there. Ken Paxton was there.
Really?
It's like a who's who of criminal fraudsters showing up to support him.
Did the word go out before, you know, because there had been a lot of bad press that his family isn't showing up, that there's nobody outside? Did the word go out, let's get some people in there, let's get some more protesters outside, et cetera?
It must have been. It must have. And I think it's interesting that, you know, that Junior, Don Junior and Ivanka didn't show up as well. That's not like they can work. You know, they're barred from running charities in the state of New York. And I think their ability to run a business has been stayed while the $175 million bond from Mr. Hankey, the subprime car loan king, actually got approved. But it's not like they're busy. So it was interesting that I think that the word went out. I think you better show up to my thing or I'll never, you know, I don't know what the threat could have been. But yeah, I think the word went out and we got a couple more protesters out there. But for Trump to go out and say they've blocked it all off, no one's allowed to be here, is just an absolute lie. There was one guy there that day. He got in.
An absolute lie. For my president, I don't think so, Allison Gill. I'm still reeling from your callback to Carter Page. That's who they were able to get to come in for Trump's trial. Good Lord. It's not going well if that's all he's got. We got to get out, guys. A delight speaking with both of you. Dr. Allison Gill can be heard on a regular basis on her Daily Beans podcast. You can follow that on the Twitters at Daily Beans Pod. You can also follow her specifically as Allison Gill on, yes, the site still known as Twitter. And Mueller, She Wrote, MuellerSheWrote.com. And Keith Barber can be found over at DailyCoast.com, where he writes under the name KeithDB. And he's also on Twitter at KeithDB80. A delight speaking with both of you guys. Allison, let's not make it another year before we find an excuse to have you back.
I agree. I think we're going to have a lot going on between now and a year from now. So I'm happy to come back.
You think? All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Brad.
You bet. All right, we have got to get out.
Yes, but that was fascinating.
Well, I hope so. and yeah, I think there's going to be a whole lot more to come. Anyway, hey, thank you very much to our producer as well, Desi Doyen.
Yep.
And thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It's always greatly appreciated and an honor. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com, today's program or any other that we have ever done. That is made possible thanks to the folks who also hit one of the donate buttons over at bradblog.com, or just go to straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. It is all up to you, and we've got a big year ahead of us, as you may have noticed, so we could really, really use your help. bradblog.com/donate. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com and on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and yes, site still known as Twitter, you will find me at The Brad Blog. We will see you there. Till we see you here next time, hopefully tomorrow. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.